Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Lincoln's Greatest Journey, 16 Days That Changed a Presidency, March 24th to April 8th, 1865. By Noah Andre Trudeau. Narrated by Barry Press. Preface. The tragic saga of Abraham Lincoln's assassination is profoundly etched in American memory, so much more so that a striking story within that story has been all but lost. That inexorable accumulation of small events and ominous portents building to a point forever frozen in our shared memory, the night of April 14th, 1865. A moment that compels our attention as few others. Some 700,000 people annually visit Ford's Theater. New books, films, documentaries, and articles about the president's martyrdom appear just about every year. The image that inevitably dominates this narrative is that of a great man helplessly caught in a fateful vortex, with virtually every aspect of his life in those final weeks viewed through the dark prism of his pending doom. It is a powerful tale, yet one that obscures Lincoln's last and perhaps greatest personal achievement as President of the United States. For all of his first term and the start of his second, Abraham Lincoln was in a fully reactive mode. "I claim not to have controlled events," he admitted in early 1864, "but confess plainly that events have controlled me." The immense task of prosecuting the war consumed him, and at times it seemed an endless ordeal. It also brought out qualities of leadership that helped define his greatness. Historian Eric Foner, who believes that Lincoln had grown enormously during the Civil War, identifies some of them as an open-mindedness, a willingness to accept criticism, a firm finger on the people's pulse, and an ability to work with just about anyone to achieve his goals. Lincoln had challenged Congress and the American people at the start of the crisis to think anew and act anew, and there's nothing to suggest that he was any less prepared to apply those skills and follow that dictum as the war was ending than he was when it began. Lincoln's crystal ball was decidedly murky at the beginning of March 1865. As late as his second inaugural address early that month, he was unwilling to predict when the war might end. Some 30 days later, everything changed. A new Lincoln emerged, one firmly on a leadership path actively anticipating the post-war era. He was at long last in a position, and equally important, a state of mind, to begin to control events. It was a transformation as remarkable as it was unprecedented. This metamorphosis from a president in time of war to one in time of peace did not and could not happen in Washington. It took place in City Point, Virginia, at the headquarters of Lieutenant General Ulysses S. Grant. Lincoln left Washington for what he intended to be a few days away from the Oval Office to rest. Those few stretched into an unprecedented 16, during which the president performed very little of the chief executive's business. Instead, he lost himself in the minutiae of a major military campaign, personally witnessed the carnage of combat, came to understand the fears and uncertainties of a defeated society, found a deeper compassion for the aspirations of a long subjugated people, steeled himself to confront the self-inflicted damage and destruction of the war, performed a striking public act of honoring the war's wounded, and in the end, reset his internal compass to begin to lead the country out of the storm. This extended period away from Washington demands our attention. Of the 52 days he was out of town during his first term, his longest continuous absence was just 8, and those trips were all business. The prospect of escaping the executive mansion to recharge was something many of Lincoln's successors would embrace as absolutely necessary. Dwight D. Eisenhower spent 456 vacation days away from the White House. Lyndon B. Johnson, 484. Franklin D. Roosevelt, 958. And George W. Bush, 1,020. President Lincoln's City Point respite represents his longest time unfettered by the official duties of his office. It is an unalterable historical fact that the singular trajectory of this new Lincoln ended in his violent death before it had fairly begun. Why, that being the case, does it all matter? It matters because it adds a new piece to the eternally fascinating puzzle that is Abraham Lincoln. It matters because it more fully reveals his determination to lead this nation into a future guided by the principles of malice toward none, charity for all. It matters also because, although no one knows precisely what Lincoln would have done in a full second term, his experiences at City Point offer tantalizing clues to some of what might have been. Most important, it signals that the man had changed and was in the process of changing more when he returned to Washington after his extended time out. Such was his greatness, and such is the story told here. In charting this great Lincoln journey, it is important to pin down details as much as possible. We need to know what he did, when he did it, what he saw, whom he met, what he said, who saw him, what they thought, what they heard. I began my research using the standard template of Lincoln's City Point sojourn. After all, it's a tale that had been told and retold over the years with little variation. I soon realized that the testimonies of the most often cited witnesses to these events were all flawed, some slightly, others substantially. I had to tear down the old edifice and build a wholly new background against which the Lincoln transformation story unfolds. Listeners familiar with the basic elements of his activities during this period will note that some celebrated stories have been expunged and the sequence of events is altered in places from the long-accepted versions. I have also added new witnesses to Lincoln's visit, many making but brief appearances. Even these little dots, when considered in the aggregate, fill in the picture. In his immortal Gettysburg speech, Lincoln spoke to the moment and looked to the future. When, 16 months later, he departed Washington for the Virginia front, the nation was still engaged in a great civil war. He returned from his trip a leader looking ahead to the challenges of bringing the nation its new birth of freedom. His point of view was forward, not backward, and his purpose was to help the nation reinvent itself, guided by one of his essential principles. As he said, "I hold that while man exists, it is his duty to improve not only his own condition, but to assist in ameliorating mankind. And therefore, without entering upon the details of the question, I will simply say that I am for those means which will give the greatest good to the greatest number." The time has come to stop defining Lincoln by the melodramatic manner of his death, and to understand him as a dynamic national leader, hardened and wearied by war, but still capable of personal growth and change. It is my hope that this book is a step in that direction. Chapter 1. January through March, 1865. It was an immense relief to him to be away from Washington. 4 years of civil war had taken a heavy toll of Abraham Lincoln. Friends and colleagues were shocked by the man they now encountered. A Springfield acquaintance visiting in late February 1865 thought that he looked badly and felt badly, apparently more depressed than I have seen him since he became president. While another, at the same time, observed that he appeared to be worn out and almost completely exhausted. "I am very unwell," Lincoln confided to a close acquaintance at this time. A reporter for the Chicago Tribune wrote that many of the president's visitors were painfully impressed with his gaunt, skeleton-like appearance, while the editor of the New York Tribune described his face as care-plowed, tempest-tossed, and weather-beaten. Lincoln was so ill by mid-March that he had to conduct a cabinet meeting in his bedroom. "I shall never live to see peace," he told Harriet Beecher Stowe at this time. "This war is killing me." The stresses began with personal matters. His wife, Mary, was continuing to show signs of what later writers would characterize as bipolar disorder, depression, migraines, and obsessive tendencies. Not having the benefit of such a modern analysis, Lincoln feared his wife was going crazy. Atop that were worries about his eldest son, Robert, who was eager to see something of the war in uniform. Father and son were willing, but Mary opposed it. "I'm so frightened he may never come back to us," she said. The matter assumed a political dimension when the First Lady was challenged by a New York senator who demanded to know, "Why isn't Robert in the army?" She finally compromised on the arrangement that saw her eldest attached to Lieutenant General Ulysses S. Grant's staff. Though not a field officer, Robert's duties put him in harm's way, and the Lincolns, who had lost a son from illness as recently as 1862, worried about losing another. Then there were the stresses connected to the office of the president. Lincoln's re-election once more opened the floodgates for job seekers eager to be rewarded for their efforts on his behalf. He tried to get ahead of the problem by announcing that he would be making very few changes this time around. Still, they came, and it seemed to Lincoln that everyone darted at him and with thumb and finger carried off a portion of his vitality. When he attended a March opera performance in the company of Colonel James Grant Wilson, he explained that he didn't come for the music. "But for the rest, I am being hounded to death by office seekers who pursue me early and late, and it is simply to get 2 or 3 hours' relief that I am here." He called on a friendly senator from New Hampshire and pleaded, "Can't you and others start a public sentiment in favor of making no changes in offices except for good and sufficient cause? It seems as though the bare thought of going through again what I did the first year here would crush me." Looming over all of this, the profound stresses of being commander-in-chief in a time of war. Lincoln was not the first American president to govern in wartime, but none of the previous occasions had so pervaded the national fabric as this. No one realized it more than the man whose decisions had sent thousands of young men to their death. Speaking in June 1864, Lincoln explained his perspective in the starkest of terms. "War, at the best, is terrible," he said, "and this war of ours, in its magnitude and its duration, is one of the most terrible. It has destroyed property and ruined homes. It has produced a national debt and taxation unprecedented. It has carried mourning to almost every home, until it can almost be said that the heavens are hung in black. Yet it continues." It speaks to Lincoln's ability to focus on what was important that, despite the distractions, he quietly and patiently pulled strings in early 1865 to assure congressional approval of the 13th Amendment, abolishing slavery. It further drained him, but he persisted and made full use of the prestige and patronage of the executive branch to muster the necessary House support. When the vote was called on January 31, 1865, it passed with just three more than the needed two-thirds majority. Lincoln declared it a great moral victory. In its aftermath, he began thinking more and more about escaping Washington for a while. Since taking office on March 4, 1861, Abraham Lincoln had been a reluctant and very occasional out-of-town traveler. During his entire first term, he had undertaken just 16 trips away from the Capitol, averaging 3.25 days apiece. These excursions invariably involved either military matters or official appearances. What passed for a rest break were the early summer and late fall weeks, variously from June 1862 to November 1864, that he spent with his family in a house on the grounds of the Soldiers' Home in Northeast Washington, an easy 3-mile ride from the White House. Even there, he was not free from the press of visitors or the need to commute nearly every day to the office to handle necessary matters. With spring military operations in the offing, some time away seemed like an unobtainable luxury. Still, he had made no definite decision when an unexpected telegram arrived on March 20, 1865, that made it for him. Approximately 130 miles south from Washington was City Point, Virginia, known today as Hopewell, just where the Appomattox River entered the James River, once the clearinghouse for shipping intended for Petersburg, 10 river miles distant. Since June 1864, it had been the logistical hub for Union forces operating against Richmond and Petersburg. Perched atop a long bluff rising over a busy waterfront and at the point of land thrust between the two rivers was the plantation manor of Dr. Richard Eppes, whose family had occupied the house for more than a century. The current residence had been uprooted when Union troops arrived, and the good doctor spent much of the war working as a contract surgeon in a Petersburg Confederate military hospital. A row of small rustic log cabins, replacing tents in the fall of 1864, stretched out in an orderly line running east of the plantation house. These unassuming habitations represented the command and control center for all the armies of the United States. A visitor about this time mused that the whole place reminds one of a frontier settlement on the skirts of our Indian territories. Near the middle of the line was a two-room structure that doubled as head and living quarters for General Grant, who had been general-in-chief for the Army's operations since March 1864. Beginning right after January 1, 1865, the cabin was also occupied by Grant's wife, Julia, and their young son, Jesse. Julia described herself as snugly nestled away and assured a friend that her general's headquarters can be as private as a home. The task of prosecuting the war was Grant's principal, but not his sole, responsibility. Even with an abundantly manned War Department in Washington and a modest staff at City Point, the general's days were filled with matters large and small. On the small side, Grant had to intervene in the first 3 weeks of March for several officers regarding official recognition of their proper ranks, investigate fraud charges laid against an officer at Fortress Monroe, and settle a turf war between the officer commanding in the Baltimore area and the irate railroad president whose trains he was appropriating. A sad personal matter was injected on March 19th, when he learned of the death of his oldest sister, Clara, who had passed away 13 days earlier. His father wrote two letters announcing the fact, the second taking his son to task for his silence. "Your last letter made me feel very badly," Grant told his father. The list of more significant items requiring his attention that month seemed endless. There were touchy issues regarding the treatment and exchange of prisoners of war. the matter of commodity traders with official Washington passes attempting to move merchandise, mostly tobacco and cotton, between the battle lines, and various military districts needing replacement officers. Important matters, to be sure, but they paled in comparison with the decisions Grant had to make every day to keep the prosecution of the war on track. The essence of Grant's overall plan was to simultaneously press the enemy across the country in as many strategic places as possible. But he found instilling a sense of urgency in distant commanders both a challenge and a frustration. Topping his list of problem people was Major General Edward R. S. Canby, headquartered in New Orleans, and charged with capturing the Confederate port of Mobile, Alabama. Grant had wanted it done back in December, when Major General William Tecumseh Sherman was beginning his sweep through Georgia, but Canby found reasons to procrastinate. He sidestepped several specific instructions Grant gave him regarding officer appointments and seemed to be spending more time building an infrastructure than organizing an advance.
"I am very much dissatisfied with Canby," Grant complained to Secretary of War Edwin M. Stanton on March 14th.
Another key officer whose actions fell below Grant's expectations was Major General George H. Thomas. Thomas had delivered a significant victory to the Union in December 1864 at Nashville, but since then he had consistently underperformed, at least in Grant's estimation. Grant did not hesitate to take from Thomas the infantry he needed to support offensives elsewhere. His hope now was that the general would dispatch his ample cavalry in several important raids, but instead of reports of actions accomplished, Grant received a litany of reasons for delay. He vented some of his frustration in a March 16th letter describing Thomas as slow beyond excuse. Every dalliance at this critical stage, Grant believed, raised the specter of a long summer of costly operations. The two shining stars in his constellation were William Tecumseh Sherman and Philip Sheridan. Of the pair, he was closest to Sherman. They shared a biography that included a hardscrabble youth, West Point studies, civilian interludes where failure was a regular visitor, and a feeling that the military life offered the only viable framework for success and recognition. Their personalities, however, were decidedly different. Sherman thought himself more susceptible to doubt than his friend.
"I am more likely to change my orders or countermarch my command than he is," explained Sherman. "He uses such information as he has according to his best judgment. He issues his orders and does his level best to carry them out without much reference to what is going on about him, and, so far, experience seems to have fully justified him."
Only Sherman could have convinced a skeptical Grant to allow the operation that became known as the March to the Sea, or that tramping his men overland from Savannah to Virginia was better than waiting for sufficient sea transportation to materialize. Both men grasped the intricacies of modern operational planning, and both had the self-confidence to know when to act and the courage of convictions to act decisively. "To you," Sherman confided to Grant,
"I can always unfold my thoughts as one worthy and capable of appreciating the feelings of a soldier and gentleman."
Grant's relationship with Sheridan was different. Grant relied on him to efficiently and effectively accomplish any task given him, just as he trusted Sherman. He knew Sheridan to be a master of the military craft, amply provided with determination, courage, and sheer force of will, unbending in his execution of orders, and ambitious. In many ways, he was Sherman without the massive intellectual framework that gave Sherman the confidence to operate independently. Sherman and Grant complemented each other and enhanced each other's skill set. Sheridan always seemed to require an element that Sherman's or Grant's support provided. With their backing, he was unstoppable.
Both men had contributed to Grant's anxieties in early March as they disconnected communications in order to carry out their missions. Each was out of contact with higher authorities for days and even weeks as they managed their operations, Sherman somewhere in North Carolina and Sheridan deep in the southern Shenandoah Valley. Grant was reduced to reading Richmond newspapers to glean some evidence of their activities, though the rebel editors always made it seem as if each had met with disaster. It wasn't until March 12th that he established direct contact with Sheridan and March 16th with Sherman. Grant could now finalize his plans to break the Petersburg stalemate, and he hoped, end of the war. He believed that his superior numbers and resources would prevail if he could lever Lee's army out of its entrenchments and transform the situation to a more fluid fight in the open. He had known this since the Petersburg campaign began in June 1864, but now, nearly a year later, everything finally seemed right. He had crafted a battle plan that he believed could get the job done. Throughout this period, Grant's contacts with President Lincoln had been occasional and not always supportive. He complained to Secretary of War Stanton on March 8th that rebel prisoners in the North are allowed to take the oath of allegiance and go free, and thought that such a program was wrong. The answer came from Lincoln, who admitted that this was happening in accordance with the rule I proposed. After explaining why he had initiated this policy, Lincoln insisted that, "On the whole, I believe what I have done in this ways has done good rather than harm." One important constant remained, however, a mutual respect. The same day Lincoln's policy note arrived, another went to the White House from Grant, recommending the appointment of the son of an Army general as a West Point cadet, a request that was promptly honored. As the days warmed, Grant had been steadily but gently lobbied by his wife to invite Mr. and Mrs. Lincoln down to visit the Army. So many people were coming, and the weather was simply delightful. Julia Grant was motivated by a simple sense of kindness. She had seen several newspaper accounts commenting on the exhausted appearance of the president, and believed a little time out of the office would do him good. The general wasn't convinced. "If President Lincoln wishes to come down, he will not wait to be asked," he huffed. "It is not my place to invite him." "Yes, it is," Julia countered. "You know all that has been said about his interference with army movements, and he will never come for fear of appearing to meddle with army affairs." Grant still shook his head. Julia now had the happy thought to consult with the one person at City Point who would know for sure. U.S. Grant had received a note from Lincoln not long after the New Year, writing only as a friend, and asking if it would be possible for his 22-year-old son Robert to enter the service as part of Grant's military family, with some nominal rank, I and not the public furnishing his necessary means. Grant promptly answered that he would be most happy to have him in my military family, and I would, say, give him the rank of captain. He also made it clear that young Lincoln should be paid and treated like any other officer. Robert Todd Lincoln's appointment was finalized on February 11th, and he came to City Point shortly after the president's second inauguration. Julia Grant now corralled him, wanting to know why his father and mother did not come down for a visit. "I suppose they would if they were sure they would not be intruding," the young man answered. Julia promptly renewed the matter with her husband, who did something he would never have done as a military man. He capitulated. City Point, Virginia, March 20th, 1865, 10 a.m. His Excellency A. Lincoln, President of the United States. "Can you not visit City Point for a day or two? I would like very much to see you, and I think the rest would do you good. Respectfully yours, etc., U.S. Grant, Lieutenant General." That telegram settled Lincoln's thinking about the matter. Although he never explained why he accepted Grant's invitation, there were compelling reasons for him to do so. To make sure that he and Grant were on the same page regarding the military end of the war. To honor the soldiers and sailors for their service and sacrifice. And to clear his mind to confront the multitude of
Sample complete. Ready to continue?